Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Runtime. I'm your host, Raphael Kennedy, and this is the podcast where we go deep into software design. This week, I'm again joined by Andre Staltz, the creator of Manyverse and Cycle.js. Thanks for coming along. And welcome back, Andre. We had a great conversation about Cycle.js, and I'm excited to get into our conversation this week.
Thanks, Raphael. It's a pleasure to be back here again.
So this is going to be the second part of our two-part episode, and in this time we're talking about a project called Manyverse. I'll give a quick summary for those not familiar with it. It's a mobile social media app that you can install on your phone right now. I have it on mine, and it's built on top of Scuttlebutt, or I guess Secure Scuttlebutt, SSB communication protocol. And I've put a link in the show notes to a 2018 video from Full Stack Fest that talks a bit about that project. I'd really encourage people to check it out. It's a fascinating utopian vision of a way we can help to reinvent the social web. The Cliff's Notes is that this is a deeply decentralized pull-based network where people and not documents are the first-class citizens. And social data is replicated from your phone or your laptop to the phones, the devices of people that are in your actual network. So a thing you brought up in the video was that the network topology is the same as the social graph, which is really fascinating, and it has some implications for creating a human-centered social network that are really, really enjoyable, and I hope that it will catch on. I would say Manyverse is a mobile app that is built on top of this Scuttlebutt protocol, kind of the way that an app like Facebook is built using the HTTP protocol.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, and I think it's all about the underlying protocols being open. So basically, we have ways of interacting on the internet, but those ways are sometimes built on top of protocols such as email and, well, let's just say XMPP, but there's other protocols. TCP/IP is the very low layer. Some of those are open, but then when it comes to things like, I don't know, WhatsApp or Facebook, then you're using something that's not open, and there's deep implications to using those closed systems.
All right. So I like to begin talking about each project with the question, why did this need to exist? What was it that the existing social platforms were doing or not doing that made a project like Manyverse necessary?
Right. So I think that all of the social media platforms are, well, most or all, depends how you define them, they are set for disaster to happen. That's because they are centralized. So because they're centralized, they have a single point of failure, be that the company or the CEO or their servers. And this is a problem for the internet because the internet has not been designed in that way. It's been designed in a decentralized manner where could have a bunch of different servers talking to each other. So for instance, email is not set for disaster as a protocol, but something like Facebook is. And let me just explain what I mean by disaster. It's any sort of deeply negative event that can happen, be it like a downtime or some government shuts down that service in their whole country. And that happens quite often. Or let's say like Zuckerberg goes rogue and he does something that deeply disappoints everybody or betrays everybody. So those disasters or negative events, they have a probability of happening. And given enough time, we know that Murphy's Law applies and those events will happen. So given that we know that everybody is using these social tools, and it seems like people will use these social tools now for the foreseeable future. We have no sign that people are stopping to use these tools, but rather the opposite, that people are depending more and more on them for their livelihoods, for their like family life, for everything. So they are set for disaster. And sometimes these disasters happen. As I said, some governments shut down these services in some countries. So recently there was Myanmar. I've also heard of India sometimes shutting down some services, and countries in Africa are frequently shutting down some of these social services. And for those people, this is a big deal, and they try to find alternatives. And it's just a matter of time that there will be these disasters for all kinds of people, be it in Western countries or not. These things will happen. So it's basically, we have a very important layer of the internet that we depend on that is not dependable. So what I set out to do with Manyverse was to create this dependability, this reliability for these social services, or basically the social use case, right? I want to talk to people in an open community through posts and likes and things like that. There has to be an open platform for that, that we can use, that is that doesn't have a single point of failure, that is open so that we can rely on it either through audits or fixing it. You know, open source has this effect of being more reliable due to these kind of scrutiny, public scrutiny. And we need that, and we don't have that. And that's quite weird. And that's what I set out to build. So I didn't originally build Scuttlebutt. It was actually the invention of a programmer called Dominic Tarr, who was very prolific at creating a bunch of Node.js modules that create this social network. And I realized that this is a beautiful protocol, but it didn't have very much friendly apps or user-friendly apps. It was quite clumsy sometimes, especially on mobile. There was nothing on mobile at that time. So I started making a mobile app that supports that, because a lot of people use social platforms primarily on their phones. And that's what Manyverse is, essentially. It's a way of using social tools that no one can shut down just over the night, you know?
Yeah, so can we talk about some of those trade-offs? So you're wanting to build a resilient and open network social tool is something that was of primary importance here. What were some of the things that you had to sacrifice in order to get there?
So one of the main problems is how do we deal with connectivity? How does Alice connect with Bob? Now, typically with social platforms, there are these servers that are hard-coded into the app, literally, and those servers contain everything. Now, if you're going to do it in a decentralized manner, you can't have these servers. So I think the trade-off that I set at the beginning was to build this in a so-called off-the-grid manner, where it could work even if you have no internet, or if you have internet, then you sort of input your favorite server. So this kind of discoverability of servers was the trade-off that I made there. And I think one of the downsides that I found was off the grid meant that you could do exciting things, such as I can update my phone with data from your phone using just Bluetooth. And that's really a great enabler for people who have poor connectivity or no connectivity, such as in the case of some countries in Africa or indigenous communities in the Amazon. Then that would make a lot of sense for them. And that's the so-called off-grid use case. But I think it is still quite difficult, because Bluetooth is actually not that reliable. So one of the things I discovered is that just simply making a Wi-Fi hotspot is much easier. So I kind of regret building all of that Bluetooth thing, because I realized that you could just make a Wi-Fi hotspot and the peers can connect to the same Wi-Fi, and then they can find each other in the LAN. So that's one of the things that I was like, well, it didn't make sense to build Bluetooth. But also, when it comes to internet servers, if you do have connectivity, then you don't want to like actually find someone nearby to connect to them directly. That's just like inconvenient. And still, the discovery of servers is a complicated issue. So right now we have a model that's similar to Mastodon. I don't know if people know Mastodon, but it's much more popular than Miniverse is. And Mastodon has this idea of, well, if you want to be part of the social network, first you have to choose a server. And choosing the server can be kind of clumsy and can be, take some time, and the server you want may not be open to you, these kind of things. We have a model that's similar to that, but in some ways it has less downsides, because your data, your account always lives on your end device. So that's one of the main trade-offs. It's a great thing. It's a great advantage that your data is on your device. You don't have to log in. No one can delete your data. I mean, no one can like remove you from having access to your account because it's on your device. But on the other hand, we have these difficulties of how do I discover people in other places? We have to sort of come to the same server and congregate and share data, or we either have to come to the same physical place and share data. So that part is still quite tricky. We are making progress. We have an interesting design called room servers. But these are the kind of trade-offs that we made. Basically, the data is local, the account is local, and you have total autonomy to share that data with other people. But it also means that you have to be autonomous and responsible for finding people and connecting with them, which is not the case in social platforms. It's just all given from the beginning.
Yeah, and it seems like there would be, if you're allowing people to connect arbitrarily to servers as part of this, there's going to be an inherent pressure towards centralization as people are trying to, you know, to join larger, more established existing networks, even given the protocol that you have. Is that pressure something that you're seeing and trying to handle?
Yes. So that is a really good point. It's kind of at the heart of everything. So in one sense, you want to support servers. So let me just make a footnote here that we basically could let Alice connect directly with Bob over the internet, but we have this major hurdle, which is network address translation, NAT, NAT, which doesn't let that happen consistently and reliably. Also because your phone, let's say, could be changing IP address sometimes and you don't have a stable IP address, you can't dial that other peer. So that's kind of why we need servers. And then to your question, how do we avoid centralization of servers? Like, it would make sense that people could just congregate in one huge server, and that would be better so people can discover each other. Yes, that sounds to be true, but there's a trick here. So let's just call that model federation, and it's what we know from email, for instance. Well, obviously there is Gmail, which is a huge provider, and federation is also used in Mastodon, which I mentioned quickly. But one thing I realized is that federation so far has been also owning your account. So when you choose a server, like an email provider, you're also choosing where does your account live. And when you choose a Mastodon instance, you're also choosing where does your account live. And what we did with Scuttlebutt Room servers is that your account does not live on that server. And this makes all the difference, because when you want to switch servers, it is much easier. So let's say you have like Raphael@gmail.com. If you want to switch that to, let's say, iCloud, it is a major hassle because you may have a bunch of people that know you by your @gmail.com address. So you have to also update all the people that you know and let them know that you have a new address. So that's a major hassle. And also you have to transfer the data itself. Now, in a federated model where you don't have that, which is in our case, what you do have is that your account is on your end device and it doesn't leave there. You don't have to transfer it anywhere. The only thing that you do is that you start congregating in a new place. And you can point people to that new place, or you could also have an address that is serving as a proxy. So you can, let's say, I could have a stable address such as ssb.stats.com, and I can update that address to point to another address such as room server A or room server B, so that when I don't trust that particular room server anymore, I can switch to another and nothing, like no real costs happen. I don't have to transfer my data. I don't have to update people of a new address. So I think that is fundamental, because I think centralization builds gradually. And what the difficulty in centralization is leaving the platforms. I think if people had more ease of leaving, people would leave. And I think what we're doing here is basically adding liquidity to federation. So it's a term from economics, but what it means is that you can quickly transfer quickly move from this to that, and it's not a big deal. On the other hand, current federated systems like email and Mastodon, they're very illiquid because they kind of work like real estate, right? Like you might live in a house, and to move to another house and let's say buy another house, it's a very illiquid process because you have to sign a bunch of things, you have to actually move out. And that's very similar to email, because your account lives on this certain land of email provider and you have to move out. So that's the problem, I think. That's why centralization gets into a stuck state, because it's very illiquid to change. So I think what we're betting on is basically making it really easy to switch, so that in case one server becomes corrupted or too big or something, then people lose trust, it is easy to switch.
Excellent. Yeah, I love the term liquidity in that context. Mm. I've never, I have an economics background, but
That's great.
I've never heard it used in that way. So if you're relying, you know, one of the things that you talked about is trust. So you have these, you know, servers that are essentially pointing to an account that lives on, you know, an end device. How do you resolve trust issues around making sure that the account that the room server is pointing to actually, you know, points to the end device that that you control?
Yeah, so let me just quickly explain how that works. So we created a thing called aliases, which are similar to email addresses. You have an address at the room, and it's called an alias. And in my case, it could be like Andre at SSB room, let's say. No, actually, it's not at. It's dot. Andre dot SSB dot room. Let's suppose that that's a hypothetical address. And it's a URL. It's literally a link on the web. And the way that it does it, it resolves to technical details of my account, such as my ID, which is a very long 64-bit code, I think. And it also resolves to the ID of the room server. So it's like a bunch of details. And when you register this alias on the server, you also sign it with your ID. And your ID is, by the way, a key pair. So when other people see that alias, they can also verify that it actually belongs to this ID. But you mentioned trust issues, and it's actually important to say that when you choose this kind of room or this kind of server, you have to trust it to some degree. You have to trust it with a specific type of data, which is connection metadata. So one of the things that we want to do with these rooms is provide a way of centralizing your IP addresses or your IP address. Now, it's interesting because I am promoting decentralization, but I'm talking about centralizing your IP addresses. But hear me out. So your IP address is personally identifiable information sometimes, and it's quite sensitive. So you don't want to spread it out everywhere. You want to keep it in a few places that you control. It's kind of like credit card number. You don't want to give it to everybody out there. So in that sense, you choose a room that you trust that they will be sufficiently, you know, trustworthy not to use that connection metadata. And that's actually better than doing direct peer-to-peer connections. If you connect to a bunch of friends and you sprinkle around your IP address to all of those friends, then you have less control over, like, hey, who did I give my address to? And could they possibly start using that in an abusive way when they stop being my friends? Because, you know, relationships are difficult. So in that sense, the room is an important point of trust concerning just that connection metadata. On the other hand, the room actually has no idea what you're talking about or what is the contents of the social network. It has no idea because it doesn't do this kind of content replication. It doesn't like fetch your data. So in that sense, you don't want to trust the room with what you're talking about. You just want to trust it on, I think you guys can handle this connection metadata, and I suppose you guys have a good privacy policy, this kind of thing.
Excellent. So we've talked a lot about the sort of the big picture, how this revolutionary social network behaves. But we haven't talked about how the actual app itself behaves. Can you talk a little bit about the process of building the, you know, the Manyverse mobile app, and about specifically using CycleJS that we talked about last week,
right?
Inside of that application.
Yeah. So obviously, when I created CycleJS, I do believe that it's a good app architecture. So I should also believe in my own words. And when I built Manyverse, I had this brief moment where I thought, how should I architect this? And I just thought, let's just do it with CycleJS, because I know that if I take a different path, I might feel like taking this tangent and solving app architecture and building other libraries and who knows, you know, other frameworks. I'm like, no, let's just use what I know and what I believe in. And I think it was a great choice, actually, because React Native is quite different than just a normal React DOM app. Because React DOM, you basically have the DOM layer and you don't have a bunch of different concerns. I mean, well, sometimes, but you usually have server data that you want to get, and you have rendering on the page. But React Native has a bunch of other things. Just as a simple example, you have a thing called toasts in Android, which is the small pop-up that come from the bottom. And those are basically UI concerns as well, but they are typically in React Native APIs, they are built with a totally imperative API, not declarative at all, which is show and hide as methods, which is surprising because React is sort of promoting declarative UIs. But it takes this imperative approach in many cases of these sort of, you know, different concerns like clipboard or links to other apps or just a ton of things. So it turns out that for each of those concerns, I have a separate so-called driver in the Manyverse code base. And I think I have more than 10 drivers, maybe 15 drivers. And these are similar to the operating system drivers because you have a driver for sound, a driver for graphics, these kind of things. And it makes sense that you would have a way of interacting with hardware capabilities, such as vibration is a thing in mobile apps and all these other concerns. And CycleJS provides an answer for dealing with all of those things. And it provides, and that type of answer is the same as for virtual DOM. So you don't have like Well, I treat virtual DOM in this way, and all of the other concerns I treat in a completely different way. You don't have these difference of usage. You have the same pattern, which is streams passed down to syncs for all of these issues. I mean, for all of these aspects. So I think that was a beautiful choice, and it's just also better to choose what you're best with. If Like in my case, I knew that I would be working mostly alone because it's an open source project that is donation driven. So I know that like there's just one main person, and it makes sense that I choose something that's productive for me, so that I'm productive.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's always a key trade-off element is what does your team, and in this case, just you, feel like they can work with. Am I correct in saying that this was your first major effort using Cycle.js for a mobile application?
Yeah, I think that's a correct assessment. I mean, I had smaller projects built with Manyverse and React, sorry, Cycle.js and React Native, but they were much smaller. I did use Cycle.js in production in real projects, but those were web projects. This was the first time React Native.
So were there things that you discovered about the library, about Cycle.js while you were using it in this completely shifted context of a mobile device? It sounds like, drivers, which are a cycle in Cycle.js, they are used to process the streams of outputs from the central function. So building new drivers for handling those mobile APIs you talked about. Were there other things that you didn't know about Cycle.js before you started this project?
So surprisingly, no. I
Okay.
think I had very little surprises. I think at that point Cycle.js was like very stable, and but there was one special thing, which is the library I use in the React Native side for navigation is called React Native Navigation, and that one has a very specific API that is also quite different to other solutions out there for React Native. And I had to figure out a way of wrapping that in a Cycle.js way. And that was a bit complex, actually, but I think it turned out to work fine because the issue with Cycle.js, or let's say the idea in Cycle.js, is that there's one function that will be representing your whole app in the end, and that's the main function. But in the case of React Native Navigation, the operating system such as Android may want to open the app directly on one of the screens as opposed to opening the whole app. So there's this concept called activities in Android, and you may want to say open that app but on that specific activity. Now, activity is usually just a screen. So I had to find a way of basically having multiple main functions in this app architecture. And those functions should also communicate with each other through events. And that was a bit complex, but mostly due to the constraints of using React Native Navigation. Other than that, it's working quite nicely.
And so, have you learned anything about the software design that you're going to use going forward on new projects for Manyverse, be they Cycle.js or just related to the design of a social application in this way?
So there's something I learned about open source components, and I think after working with Scuttlebutt and Miniverse, I realized that modular is a really nice way as opposed to monolith. And this is an approach that is usually not so common in among front-end developers or mobile developers. They usually prefer a monolith approach, which is give me a library that has everything that I would ever need, while a modular approach is more mostly like I will have a small Lego piece for each single concern that I can think of. And I think I prefer the modular approach nowadays because you can compose things as opposed to changing them over time. And I think that's an important way of thinking about software engineering that for me was very helpful because reasoning about new versions of software, new breaking changes, and new APIs, I think is more complex than reasoning about different Lego pieces that don't change, but that you can swap them out for each other. And I started to design new libraries and new components in that fashion. So mostly trying to find basically the way of composing them is very important. So you kind of create that as a convention or a standard, and you don't change that standard. You're just like, this is the convention, and we will not change it. We will either migrate to a new convention, but we will not change that one. And having all of those Lego pieces abide by those conventions, I think that really changed the way I build software. And it also gave me some perspective of how I would build CycleJS and Extreme if I would start from now. So for instance, the way that I designed callbacks was pretty much inspired by the work that I saw in the SSB Scuttlebutt modules. So callbacks is really interestingly built in that it doesn't have a core library, it just has a convention. And then all of the libraries are individual Lego pieces, and some of them are just like 4 lines of code as a single package. So it doesn't have like give me the callback framework or library. It just has a bunch of Lego pieces. And what's very surprising is that people in the community understood this concept of Lego pieces and conventions, and they started building so many utilities and libraries that I didn't think of. And they started also automatically updating the wiki pages for callback. And it basically became a huge undertaking that requires zero maintenance for me, which was quite interesting. And I'm mostly looking forward to using this modular approach as I go forward.
That's a really interesting thought about the modular approach, is that you give, contributors a bite-sized piece of something that they
Exactly.
can build and own throughout. That is sort of a not exactly computer-related but human-related design consideration, but I think probably very valuable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if the core of this utility is not a core application, or not a core code construct, but rather a convention, how do you help that to enforce this convention across these utilities? Do you like import shared tests, or are there ways that you can ensure that these utilities are all conforming to the same the conventions assumed by the consumers of these utilities?
Right. So that is one thing that I tried to build. It's actually quite difficult to test that sometimes. I even try to use property-based tests. Those are quite common in the functional programming community, but it's kind of difficult. But it's also difficult to sort of label which of these abide by the conventions or not, because everything is a wiki, you know? It's difficult to like apply consistent rules in wikis, but people have a way of sort of figuring out which ones work and which ones don't. It's kind of like buggy React components versus non-buggy React components. People kind of tend to use the ones that are not buggy, and there's not that much like, of course, you could manually choose those ones for yourself that abide by the conventions in a strong manner, but in a global manner, there's very little that we can do to like make sure that everything is working as it should, but things still happen to work as they should. It's just, I don't know how to explain it.
Well, excellent. I mean, that's good to hear. And I guess that's a pattern that we see, like Webpack loaders or things like that have
Yeah.
a similar
Yeah, actually, just to make a note on this, I was reading a book called Here Comes Everybody that mentions how Wikipedia works. And the reason why Wikipedia works is that there's a lot of people who care about the contents of the articles, and that vandalizing is easy to revert. It's easier to revert a vandalism than it is to do the vandalism. And that's why there's not that much vandalism. And I think it applies also in a situation of many plugins or many small modules, is that if something is like completely nonsense, people will figure it out and they can easily like filter it out. Of course, there is some work of curation that is moved on to the end user, but you can also package a set of curated modules and bless it specifically if you want. You can just put a bunch of Lego pieces together, bless it, and then people can trust that thing. And I think things just work. I haven't seen problems with this.
Excellent. All right. So I guess one last thing is, we've talked about, you know, about Manyverse, and I would encourage people to pull it down. I think it's, at the time of recording, still in beta, but definitely usable, and I would love to see this take off. But apart from installing and using and telling their friends about Manyverse, are there ways that people can get involved?
Sure. So one of the basic ways how people can get involved is helping to translate if they know some other languages other than English. I made a really easy way of helping us translate it. And if we could have most of the languages above 90%, that's a great thing. And it's sort of low key because there's a good platform for translations called Crowdin. And it just makes it like super fun to translate. I can't explain. There's just UI is very nice to translate stuff. But also getting into the Scuttlebutt community is a really great thing. A lot of people enjoy it. It's sort of tech savvy at the moment. So there's quite a lot of hackers and people that like intriguing niche things. But we do find good community and quite little friction and you know, like division. We don't have that much of that. And yeah, just getting to know it. And obviously, I said it's not absolutely user friendly. I try to keep on making it better. We also had a professional UX designer work with us for 3 or so months, and we made a lot of things better. But it's still on the tech savvy side, because as we said with those trade-offs last week, is that there's still this like difficult part of how do I discover people that we're still trying to figure out, and that's why it's still important to label it as beta.
Excellent. Well, I will include links to some of the things that you mentioned in the show notes, and especially any listeners who speak languages other than English should certainly join and try and help this translation effort. Thank you again for your time, Andre. It's been wonderful talking to you about this project, and I really appreciate you being here with me. This is a wonderful thing you're building, and I hope to see it really take off in the future.
Thanks, Raphael. This was a really nice chat, and it touched a bunch of different topics that I didn't thought we would touch. So that's rich. It's really nice.
Well, that wraps it up for this week on The Runtime. I remain your host, Raphael Kennedy. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe and, if possible, leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice. It really helps to spread the word. If you have thoughts, feedback, or ideas of folks that I should interview for the show, please reach out either via email at raphael@runtimepodcast.com or on Twitter @podcastruntime. Thanks again for listening.